Hello, UK. This is Basel calling. It's The Wonky Show. A new immigration white paper's out. We'll get across the detail and the implications. Plus, a minister is taking universities to task, but are her concerns reasonable? It's all coming up.
I famously dealt with an institution where they failed on the basis that they had one student from India who decided to go home for a family emergency, and that was it.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to score a douze point on this week's news, as usual, three excellent guests. In Birmingham, Smita Jamdar is partner and head of education at Shakespeare Martineau. Smita, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week was Tuesday night when we went out to celebrate one of the team's birthdays, and we just had a fantastic evening. Drank far too much, ate far too much. What more can you ask for?
What, on Tuesday?
Yeah, I know. You have to fit it in when you can.
You missed semi-final one. Unbelievable news. In Exeter, Roscoe Hastings is Director of Teaching Excellence and Student Experience at the University of Exeter. Roscoe, your highlight of the week, please.
12,000 people taking part in Exeter Pride on Saturday, Jim, and I've got the joy outside of work of being part of the organising committee for that.
12,000 people. Fantastic news. And in Argyle this week, James Coe is Associate Editor at Wonky. James, your highlight of the week, please.
Jim, it's been a week of highlights, but a particular one for me is I had the opportunity to go to Liverpool John Moores University's Place and Partnership Plan, where their Pro Vice Chancellor Dr. Aileen Jones told us all the amazing things they're doing to make Liverpool better where I live.
The three P's, fantastic. So let's start the week with the government's new immigration white paper. The long-awaited policy on legal migration emerged this week from the Home Secretary. James, what's in there?
Jim, I've got a feeling that this might not just be the topic for this week, but the topic of higher education of this Parliament. I think this could be the week. So, headlines, immigration white paper. It's been in the works for a long time. The graduate route is going to be cut from 2 years to 18 months for UG and PG. Crucially, we do not believe for PhD students. There's a ramping up of compliance measures, which by the government's own assessment, a number of providers would fall foul of in their current state, and a few would never meet. And they're going to make UKVI be even sterner with universities and the things that they are doing. There's big changes to skilled workers, some good news on global talent. But the biggest surprise is a mooted international student levy on fees, which the government for now says, but of course there is no guarantees, would go back into the higher education and skills system. An indicative figure of 6% on international fees is mooted. It's an enormous change. It will disrupt higher education in all kinds of ways should it come to pass. And it feels like a bit of a reckoning for the sector.
Now, Yvette Cooper introduced the white paper, obviously, to Parliament. Let's have a brief listen.
Immigration needs to be properly controlled and managed, and it hasn't been. Overseas recruitment shot up while training in the UK was cut. Lower skilled migration soared while the proportion of UK residents in work plummeted. In 2019, 10% of skilled work visas went to non-graduate jobs. By 2024, that had risen to 60%. Employers were even given a 20% wage discount if they recruited for shortage jobs from abroad, actively discouraging them from paying the going rate or training here at home. Education institutions were allowed to substantially expand the number of overseas students without proper compliance checks.
Well, there's lots to unpack here then, all sorts going on. Roscoe, let's look at the reduction in the graduate route visa first. What sort of impact do you think that's going to have?
I think it's going to be significant. I mean, we are hearing, you know, some government sources suggesting that, you know, this was potentially worse than what's come out in the white paper. And so, you know, what has come out is actually potentially better than it could have been. But it really does not put UK higher education on a good footing to continue to attract international students at a time when institutions are already seeing declining international numbers. And it's only going to harm the government's productivity and growth agenda.
Have you seen this piece of maths that's in there, Roscoe? I mean, hat tip to Michael Salmon for spotting this. A Home Office survey found that 14% of students would be dissuaded by cutting the graduate route completely. And so they therefore calculated the impact of removing a quarter of it down to 3.5%, as if you can just scale it down like that.
It's crazy. And I, you know, considering the impact being, you know, 30,000 fewer international students at a time when there is already declining international numbers last year, this year and next year, this is just a major body blow for the sector at a time when we're already really struggling. And it feels as though the government is making a lurch to the right time when the sector really needs it to stand behind it. And obviously the item we're going to talk about a bit later, I think, talks more to that as well.
But just while we're talking about this, Roscoe, the other thing that strikes me is that for students that are sort of already here, my understanding is that the graduate route visa is a new visa. So they've you know, been recruited to the UK, lured to the UK, I guess the press would say, on the promise of a two-year graduate route visa. And presumably, if they haven't applied yet, you know, partly because they haven't finished their course or haven't got their results, that's now being cut to 18 months. That feels particularly unfair.
Very much so. I mean, obviously the detail is lacking at the moment. And so when this comes in for whether or not existing students will be able to continue under the existing rules, or if there will be a kind of a change in cycle, as you've kind of described, Jim, we don't know. But yeah, many students have chosen to come to the UK precisely because of the opportunity to stay on for 2 years after they've completed their degree and their qualification. I mean, we're already seeing nervousness from our international student community. We're already being asked questions about this. And so it is a deeply unsettling time for any international students thinking about the UK, let alone those that are already here.
I would suggest, Smita, that given the new wider definition of material information in the Digital Markets Competition and Consumers Act, providers would do well to start talking to students about this right now.
I mean, I think, Jim, the issue is that in a way, if it's very unlikely that well, I don't know, actually. I'm saying it's very unlikely. When you're describing the service you are providing and the information that's relevant to that, you may be linking to information that the government's producing about visas, etc. I guess providers who've gone further than that and relied on those as a reason for people to choose the UK over somewhere else absolutely should be looking at what they're publishing. But as Roscoe said, the difficulty we've got is we don't actually know yet exactly how it will be implemented and exactly how it will affect people who are already here, or actually, to your point, more people who are applying now. What exactly are we telling them? When is this coming in? And it's yet another example of how, let alone having a long-term stable policy on something, changes are being brought in with no consideration to how they actually need to be implemented within universities and how they'll affect current application cycles, current recruitment, etc.
What's your reading, Smita, of the sort of, you know, the policy decision here? Because 18 months just sounds, it just sounds like a fudge, doesn't it? It sounds like the result of a five-hour meeting where no one could agree.
I know. I mean, the whole thing feels to me, I think, as Roscoe said, when you look at the other agendas that the government's trying to pursue, when you look at the overall state of higher education, it feels like a really messy compromise between we've got to do something about immigration. The polls are telling us we've got to do something about immigration, but we don't want to go as far as cutting graduate visa entirely. So we'll find some compromise, which, you know, doesn't really help anybody, because in a few years' time, or maybe even in a few months' time, because that's how quickly complaints about immigration seem to escalate, we'll probably find people saying, well, 18 months is too long. These people are staying here. They're not doing the right jobs, etc. I mean, there's so much there which is thoroughly objectionable in terms of how international students are being presented and how they are, what they are legitimately doing once they are here. We know that just, you know, immediately after they finish, they need to start earning some money. They may well be doing jobs that are not graduate level at that point. What's wrong with that? Everybody does that. It's just crazy to think that there's something wrong with that. But that's how the dialogue has gone. And that's why we're seeing this chipping away at a route that, you know, not that many, that long ago was taken away entirely, then brought back, then removed. That kind of flipping and flopping is just so completely unacceptable to people who are making decisions about their lives and their futures.
James, I guess one of the things that we have learned this week, and to be fair, you know, we also heard this at the Secret Life of Students, is significant concern actually from international students, particularly on PGT courses, about graduate recruitment and their prospects, right? But I look at this and think, you know, we already know that lots of employers are really nervous about taking on someone on a graduate route because perhaps they don't understand it or whatever. If right now the maximum they can sort of do that for is 18 months, that has actually quite a significant impact potentially, doesn't it, on their kind of confidence to take on an international student?
Yeah, of course it does. But I think one of the things, Jim, is that we're all sort of pretending that this is a policy decision and not a nakedly political one in order to win more seats in an election, right? Of course, reducing the graduate rate from 2 years to 18 months will be the case that employers will be more nervous about employing international students. Of course, it will depress the number of international students who come into the country because it makes it less appealing. And the knock-on effect of that is that it will severely financially damage universities. But the political assumption or the political trade-off in this is that harming universities is less important to your electoral success than being seen to reduce immigration. I think it's an absolute nonsense and a fiction that that will work. Jim, have you ever been to Runcorn, where the election was?
Right.
So if you've been to Runcorn, you will know there is not a single university in Runcorn. There is not a university in Helsby. There are not a university in the mining villages of County Durham, albeit there isn't Durham itself. Those people are not going to vote Labour because they have depressed student immigration by a few thousand. It is a wrong-headed political decision through which then you have to justify an increasingly set of absurd policy choices, like reducing the graduate route to 18 months, like having all these arbitrary figures on compliance with UK of AI, of saying, oh, actually, the agents framework will be made to be mandatory, which of course we think it should have been all along. All of this comes from that central premise that will be good for voters. And that's why I end up with this weird mismatch and poorly thought out policy decisions.
Yes, this is quite the mess, isn't it? Now, Roscoe, what else is in there that is, I guess, concerning the sector? What else is, you know, generating all the red flags?
I mean, the major one is this new levy on international fee income. That feels as though that has come completely left field. There's a suggestion that this is going to be around 6% of international fee income, some claims that it's going to be reinvested back in higher education and skills. I mean, as with all of this, very, very light on detail, more to come in the autumn budget. I mean, beyond how they go about working out and auditing what international fee income is, I don't know. Again, it comes back to my point around kind of a body blow to the sector at a time when home fees have been static, international recruitment is declining, national insurance increases are going up. To have another tax on universities feels just unconscionable, I think, as kind of Smita said earlier. It feels as though the whole tenet of what successive governments, not just this government and last government, but successive governments have kind of had a social contract with the sector has been, you know, you can recruit international students in order to subsidise home undergraduate tuition and research. And this just feels as though it completely undermines that kind of contract that we've had without any understanding about the knock-on consequences and impacts.
Smita, I guess, you know, of course, in context, in terms of where the sector's at and what it's been encouraged to do and so on, this feels left field, highly problematic and so on. But I guess in my head, there is at least in principle, an argument that says, look, if you've got a chunk of provision and all of the money flows directly to providers, the state does have some costs, doesn't it, in terms of other things it needs to provide for those people. And, you know, we don't levy VAT on international student fees. So there is at least in principle an argument that says that the state should retain and redistribute a slice of that income, isn't there?
Up to a point, I suppose there might be. I think there's a number of issues in there. So firstly, the levy, as I understand it, you know, as Roscoe said, it's very, very sort of thin on detail, isn't about those other services. It's about reinvestment back into higher education. And that feels to me, and skills. And that feels to me like a bit of a nonsense because, as you've said, everybody with, you know, any understanding of higher education at all knows that those fees already subsidise higher education and skills provision. So, you know, it's like taking it from one thing and putting it in exactly the same place, but directed by government rather than by autonomous providers. The second thing is, for certain services, we obviously already have additional fees. We have the health surcharge and things like that. And finally, these people pay a lot of money in visa fees.
The most expensive in the world, is my understanding.
Exactly. Many, many ways in which the state could take money if that's what this was about. I find it very difficult to understand what the purpose of that levy is, because I don't know if it plays into what we're going to be talking about later, some sort of burgeoning belief in government that universities are wasting money and not reinvesting it wisely into their core business. I mean, we can discuss whether there's any merit to that concern at all later, but otherwise it doesn't make any sense. It's already going into those very things, so why move it away from universities into something else?
No, Smita, I couldn't agree more, and I think there's a couple of bits on that. It's not even the understanding of higher education, it's the understanding of economics, right? So the reason why the UK has been such a flourishing place for higher education is because we're really good at it. International students want to study here and pay a shedload of money for the privilege for doing so. Then they get jobs and pay tax and reinvest into the economy again. And then we say, actually, we're going to make steps to depress the ability to do that, which in turn actually reduces the value of higher education and its net value to the exchequer. Like, it makes absolutely no sense in its own terms. If you look at the Australian version, where this was floated in the Universities Accord, they proposed a tax on some of the leading international recruiting universities to set up a kind of sovereign wealth fund, which would support the rest of the sector. So basically, the sector can get out of kilter. I think there is something in that, that if we believe we have a national sector and a single sector, there should be some sort of redistribution model. But I don't think this is it. I think one of the other big difficulties is, if you were sort of the minister who's in charge of immigration, but not all that bothered about higher education, Labour was elected with a mandate to reduce net migration. And then when they look at the numbers of international students coming to universities, it has gone up significantly in a really short period of time. The problem is that reducing student migration is made much easier, both technically and actually the culture of doing it. There's not as many votes to be lost than all the other kinds of much harder migration that we see in the immigration white paper, like clamping down on care workers, for example.
Roscoe, I guess just on this levy, if it is, because I mean, the thing about the health surcharge is it doesn't actually go to the health service, right? I mean, it's just a treasury, you know, it just goes flow straight to the treasury. If it's retained inside Department for Education, aimed at higher education, you know, tops up things like the National Mental Health Initiative and so on, or indeed supports some of the kind of, you know, the good things that we might hope or end up in the international education strategy, then although universities aren't going to be able to keep the money, that would at least be good news, wouldn't it?
Yes and no. I think, like I said, Jim, the detail is so scant at the moment that it's really hard to kind of comment on whether or not it is good news for the sector. I think all of the things that you've called out there, you know, absolutely would be great to see them supported. I think, as James says, though, is this the way to do that? I'm really not convinced.
But I mean, just on this, Roscoe, right? From an international student's point of view, they shell out a ton of money and a large chunk of it is redistributed to other things and other students and other people. Really, what's going on here is someone else is going to redistribute it. Now, you know, I understand why the sector is hopping mad about that, but at least in principle, from an international student's point of view, they don't really care who is doing the redistribution as long as some of it is going on them, do they?
Again, potentially, but I think, you know, when you're taking out potentially significant income from the institutions, our ability then to deliver excellent, you know, teaching, learning, student facilities is significantly compromised. So the experience that they may then get on their programme in their institution is at risk. I mean, it's interesting what James was saying earlier about, you know, the kind of some of the politics around it. I mean, I don't know if anybody saw the Public First report that came out as well, and it's looked at international student income as a percentage of each parliamentary constituency's exports. I mean, for Exeter, it represents 17% of the city's exports, and it's our number one export. It's around 129 million. You know, that is creating jobs locally here. And so again, I do feel as though there's not always a kind of thinking through by the government around some of the knock-on kind of consequences. You know, the Chancellor talks about growth and kind of productivity being the number one goal of government. And this just feels as though we're kind of eroding some of that.
For me, there's this real danger that we start sort of disaggregating what the university experience is for all students. So you made the point that obviously the income from international students is used to fund other things, not just their experience. And we hear the same argument made about, you know, why would we fund reasonable adjustments for disabled students when I'm not benefiting from them? But of course, that can't stand. I mean, the university experience is an entire thing. The range of courses that can continue to be maintained, the range of facilities that can continue to be maintained, the research that goes on. We need to get out of this trap that came in my view, when we did the Higher Education and Research Act and separated research and teaching as a big split from the idea that you pay for a certain thing when you go to university. You know, yes, I'm not saying consumer protection doesn't matter. Of course it matters. But I'm saying that we can't lose sight of the fact that you pay, everything you pay for is not an itemized list that's just for you. You benefit from the whole that's on offer there. And I think it's really dangerous when we start saying, well, should they get some of that levy back on them? Because the whole thing is wrong. You know, the service encompasses the entire university and everything it has to offer.
If you think of just international students, just in economic terms, we have private demand for a public good, which makes it feasible to exist for UK taxpayers. Like, it, regardless of like anything else, I just think trying to dampen that demand either means that you allow one of the very, very few things the UK is good at, or you then just say, okay, fine, we're just going to let the thing go to the wall. Like, it seems to make no sense in any terms.
But Roscoe, let's think about Exeter for a second, right? So one of the other things in the white paper is, if you wanted to expand your CAS allocation, the number of students that you would like to recruit, there's a kind of vague line in there that says there will be a new requirement to sort of demonstrate that you've thought about the impact on the local area, which I've, in my head, have translated as people probably wouldn't be able to do what happened in 2022 when there was very rapid expansion and not enough housing for anyone in most cities, right? Now, I can see how Exeter will be able to do that because there's only really one major higher education provider in that city. How on earth do you do that in London? I mean, what do you have to do? Do you have to put all the universities in a room to talk about the impact on the city?
Again, yeah, I've got no idea how they are going to operationalise that requirement. When you've got multiple institutions within a locality, I think London, as you kind of say, is a really great example. Students are spread all over the city, and therefore different institutions, and outside the city, absolutely, different institutions will have a different impact. And again, how far does that extend in terms of beyond accommodation? But is it also around other local services? Is it around, you know, the positive impacts as well? I think, you know, that is one thing that, you know, I would really want to see, is that we're not just thinking about the negative consequences, but actually how does increasing international students contribute positively, you know, to the local economy as well? But I don't envy the people in the Home Office that are going to have to think about, you know, how they're going to work this in practice.
And I guess, you know, the other thing of note, Roscoe, is that, and this is probably more negative, is there are three compliance metrics, aren't there, that are currently used, and they're going to change the sort of baseline acceptable level of each of those metrics, aren't they?
Yeah, so the basic compliance assessment threshold is going to be raised by 5%. That is significant across the sector. You know, some institutions will kind of barely notice that because they're well within those limits, but it will put quite a few institutions in a challenging position. They've also kind of referenced giving kind of RAG ratings based on that basic compliance assessment threshold, and therefore potentially limiting the number of CASs for those in the kind of red or kind of amber space, which is only going to further harm those institutions. So I think it is very worrying to kind of see, again, how some of that will have quite material consequences when you look at it across the sector.
Roscoe, I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head. Was it something like 20 or 30 institutions would fall foul of the regulations as they are, and then there's like a handful which could never meet them by the government's own analysis?
That sounds about right, James, yeah.
If there's only one thing I like more than bronze, silver, gold, and that's red, amber, green. But I mean, one of the things about those metrics and that assessment, because as you say, there's a sort of line in there that says, you know, that calculates the number of providers that, if they implemented it today, would fall foul of the metrics. We don't ever get to see that published, do we? Or am I missing something? And in some ways, you know, again, I can make an argument that says students should probably be able to see the results of those metrics, shouldn't they?
I mean, I would just come in on the metrics point, because we do a lot of work with very wide range of institutions. I mean, this keeps talking about universities, but obviously people who sponsor students are not just universities. There are lots of others who do it. And when you're dealing with very small numbers, you are at quite a high risk of failing those metrics, Jim, because it only takes one student not to complete, and suddenly you're below 90%. So on their own, they're not very meaningful. And the things they might be talking about as never going to meet or at risk of failing could all be those very, very small providers. I famously dealt with an institution where they failed on the basis that they had one student from India who decided to go home for a family emergency, and that was it. So, you know, there is kind of, there are metrics and there are metrics. And so we do need to be a little bit careful about this whole, well, we're just going to name and shame.
It is a completely different world to, you know, OFS though, isn't it? I mean, OFS has some similar sort of, you know, metrics for B3. And, you know, there was an 18-month consultation and people are, you know, kicking off left, right and centre about the process of assessment. This is just the Home Office does it.
Jim, I've double-checked my numbers. It was 22 HIs, but not not meet at least one of their criteria. But the interesting thing, and I forgot this when talking about the assumptions, of the five, the assumption is they would not be able to sponsor students for at least a year. I mean, the punishment for falling foul of the metrics of being unable to meet them, of not sponsoring students for a year, is tantamount to saying you will go bankrupt. It's huge. It's such a, again, like if you look at the comparisons of the OFS, the types of swinging punishments by comparison seems enormous. And I'm not an OFS sympathizer on this podcast, Jim, as you know.
Smita, I mean, look, you know, and in some ways, when the Labour government took over in Australia, there was some tightening of immigration. But my perception, you know, from the other side of the world, was it did feel like the equivalent of DfE and the equivalent of the Home Office had actually sort of got together and properly planned, you know, and thought about the kind of relationship between the two departments and the impact on universities and so on. This really does feel like dysfunctional government again, doesn't it? Which is a theme we return to endlessly on this podcast.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the sort of disappointing things, I think, here, because albeit they weren't specifically talking about higher education, you did at least hope that one of the things this government was going to try and do was to look across departments at issues and try and reach a sensible conclusion, not driven by the particular priorities of each department, but by what was needed. So if we're talking about growth, you look at everybody that's got a role to play in growth and you say, you know, talk to each other, pull your fingers out and come up with a policy that supports growth. It's not a new issue, though. I mean, pretty much ever since the new visa system was introduced, the Home Office has been dictating a lot of institutional responses. It has been interfering with a lot of institutional decisions. It has been restricting a lot of institutional activities. So this is, you don't even need to look at Australia. You just look at the history here that no one is thinking, because the Home Office's remit is to deal with immigration, it's not thinking about the wider impacts, the benefits, the positive contribution, etc. It's just saying, here's a number we can cut. And as we all know, this is a number that it's easy to cut because it is controlled migration and can be cut relatively quickly. And you then say we've achieved our limited goal of reducing immigration and hang the consequences.
I think it really demonstrates that Treasury and the Home Office are driving current government priorities, and the DfE has got very little ability to kind of influence the policy decisions that come out of either Treasury or Home Office.
And the position is even worse than that, Roscoe, because DfE's priority is not universities either.
Exactly.
So universities are literally invisible.
Bottom of the list.
To a huge amount of the policy-making machine. And that is very, very dangerous.
What one point I would make, right, is one of the real difficulties in this is there are vast swathes of the country who are generally sceptical about immigration. And although they are sceptical about student immigration, the people who generally work in universities are not, because of the nature of our work and sort of our political leanings. And there has to be a way that either we can talk to the people who are sceptical about immigration about why student immigration is generally a good thing, either meet their views somewhere in the middle and say, look, your concerns are reasonable in some ways but not in others, or we have to make it more politically difficult to cut student migration, which, you know, UUK are doing an admirable job of. But I think it's probably a long time since we've had to flex that muscle quite so directly, as it were. And look, this is a white paper. Who knows what's going to change between now and various bits of legislation that I'm sure will come to pass.
But James, I hear you, and that makes sense. But I mean, I think, and DK's publishing something on this in the next few days, I think. You know, the reality is that the most sceptical on immigration voters, reform voters, generally aren't even living in areas that have got student migration. You know, it's not as if, you know, it's not as if universities could talk to their local communities. They have to talk to other local communities. Now, maybe, you know, you can make an argument that they should, but I mean, this is a different type of work, this, isn't it?
Except in places like Lincoln, of course, where you've got Andrea Jenkins now. I think the difficulty is, right, Jane? So the politics behind this, we could go and do a big campaign and say, yes, international students are a good thing and they bring in all this income, but that can only be part of it because people's feelings aren't shifted by saying how much something is worth in terms of GDP. Like, people's feelings are moved by understanding at sort of a deep cultural level that having a university in a place is a good thing. And the thing which makes the university able to do good stuff is primarily driven by a wonderful set of international students who choose to risk an awful lot of money and an awful lot of their life to come here. Ultimately, the case to defend international students is that people feel like universities are worth defending. And even where those places that universities aren't, they will usually have tentacles in there. So look at Runcorn, for example. Their factories there rely on graduates from the University of Liverpool. The college there has a collaboration with the University of Stafford. It has to feel more real in order to be worth defending.
I'll tell you what is interesting though, James. So in the Netherlands, where obviously the populists ended up getting enough votes to kind of lead a coalition, actually that populist coalition, there's a couple of populist parties in that coalition, it now is quite split, because one of the parties, which is kind of dedicated to, you know, non-cities basically, and you know, they're kind of equivalent to Britain's seaside towns, is now very, very upset that some of the reduction in international students is having an impact on some of those economies. So, you know, I mean, we might have to just see this play out to start to see, you know, reality catching up with the rhetoric here, mightn't we? Or do you think there's a way to kind of head it off beforehand?
I don't think in terms of politics that people always sort of conceptualize two things at the same time. So if you look at the wider immigration white paper, I don't think the constituency that the Labour Party assumes will be in favour of reducing migration through care work, for example, will also then say, well, I've now got no one to care for me in my older age, therefore I wish you hadn't reduced migration. I don't think forces work like that. I think the sort of more fundamental challenge is, if you go down the route of universities getting gradually worse because of reduction in international student fees, then the case to defend them only becomes harder, because by the nature of having less cash, their impacts are reduced. Like, it makes no sense on any front to say this will win votes on migration, because it won't. You can't see through the results of it, because the damage will be done by that point. And at the same time, universities can't turn around and say, well, look, the elected government wants to do this, we're going to try and frustrate it in some way. You have to find an accommodation between those things. And I think that is the real sort of political terrain that the likes of the mission groups in Universities UK are going to have to walk carefully.
But Roscoe, this thing about not being able to have two things in your head at once, right? So when I was looking at the announcements, the big announcements actually, both in Canada and Australia over the past 18 months, one of the things about, you know, even in Australia, where, you know, the kind of Murdoch press is very strong, the debates about immigration do talk about that sort of, we need immigration because our population's getting older and, you know, the birth rate is falling. There's a more honest conversation about immigration. Should it be universities that try to have that conversation? Because at the moment, the line from universities tends to pretend that, oh, well, take students out the net migration figures, they're only kind of tourists, you know, they're not really here for a long time. Isn't the problem then, if we say that as a sector, and then the government doesn't talk about the need for immigration either, that no one starts to understand the fundamental problem in the economy, which is we're getting older and we're not having kids?
Completely. And I think, yes, I think universities could play more of an active role in trying to kind of set some of that narrative. I think also we could be trying to more explicitly link it to some of the work around, you know, graduate outcomes and employability, and actually thinking about the types of graduates that we need for the future requirements of the, you know, the country and the economy are precisely why we want talent from across the world, including the including the UK, in order to meet those demands. So yeah, I definitely a role for us to play more there.
Now, Smita, just before we come off this, there's an EU summit next week, and the news this week about the post-Brexit talks is that the EU are attempting to insist on EU students, while they're here as part of a youth mobility deal, being able to pay the same fees that home students pay. Now, that would be a jolly good idea in principle, wouldn't it? But I guess for university finances, perhaps not so much.
Well, I suppose, bearing in mind that we know that home fees do not cover the cost of many courses. I mean, some they may barely cover, but certainly lots they don't. The answer would be no. But then on the other hand, there has been such a decline in EU students as a result of Brexit that, you know, you could see it as an opportunity at least to give, you know, where we've seen numbers collapsing in certain subject areas, bringing some numbers back to sustain those subject areas and those particular types of provision. Whether or not you can charge the higher fees that you can charge to international students, that is just a trade-off institutions are going to have to make. Do you need some people so you can make a subject viable from a numbers point of view?
Did you see the quote from Lord Frost earlier on in the week, the old Brexit negotiator? Lord Frost said, we shouldn't sign up to anything like this because there will always be more students trying to come to the UK than UK students going elsewhere, because the UK's universities are excellent. I've got this feeling that if the youth mobility deal is done, there'll be a huge level of demand for that in the first few years.
The UK is not forget an attractive offer for international young people. It's not got an attractive offer for its own young people.
Good. Now let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Nikki King, an Associate Pro Vice Chancellor for Education at the University of Exeter. and along with my colleague Jess Johnson, we've been blogging about our experience of transforming pastoral support. Our model embeds pastoral mentors into every department. These are dedicated student support professionals who are friendly, approachable persons students can speak to whenever they are struggling. Pastoral mentors also take responsibility for proactive outreach to students whose low engagement puts them at risk of failure or who might be encountering other challenges during their study. In this piece, we outline our model, but also focus on the key features of that model that others may be able to implement in their own institutions. We also discuss the lessons learned about delivering an institutional change project in this space.
Now, next up, the Skills Minister has been taking universities to task in the Telegraph. Three T's there. Roscoe, what's been happening?
Yes, so the Minister, Jackie Smith, was writing in the Telegraph at the weekend, and it's interesting reading it back now, following the publication of the immigration white paper that we've just been talking about. In her piece, the Minister outlines initially the great reputation that UKHE has globally and how people flock to the UK to learn and research from all over the world. And she goes on to recognise the threat that UK higher education is under and reflects on the, quote, neglect of previous governments. So far, so good. However, she then goes on to describe, in what I'm going to see as a kind of major body blow for the sector, how universities have, quote, lost sight of their responsibility to protect public money. And she calls out a series of things: over-reliance on international students, the challenge of executive pay, not delivering on graduate outcomes, the need to continue to invest in gold standard teaching and facilities, and that universities aren't doing enough to rein in spending are some key challenges. She kind of starts to summarise by saying that she wants universities to be engines of growth and prosperity and to break down barriers to opportunity, and calls on universities to do our bit. And then she finishes with a quote from the Labour Arts Minister under Harold Wilson, Jenny Lee, saying that only the best is good enough. And it feels to me, if they're wanting the best, they are certainly not putting in the sector anywhere near a position for us to deliver even good enough at this stage.
Now, Smita, we maybe shouldn't overanalyze a Telegraph op-ed, but yesterday, actually, I was looking at, and it's brilliant, I'll post a link to this in the show notes. I was looking at an analysis of the minister in the Netherlands, who is, you know, from the big populist party, an analysis of how he'd been talking about university cuts, right? And it says a bunch of things. So it says, first of all, he regularly expresses trust in the system generally, but then he always blames other causes for the cuts. He says they're not his responsibility, they're the university's fault, managing their own budgets. He calls for everyone to be patient because there's not a lot of money around and they're trying to rebuild the economy. Then he also says how people implement cuts is up to institutions. So, you know, they should do it in a way that's good for students, not bad. And then he always says it's not for him to understand the specific factors that might lead to job losses or individual course cuts. Now, I don't want to over-egg this, but to the extent to which that's a populist playbook, it doesn't half sound like they're following it.
Oh, I mean, Jim, if you go back to the infamous list of things that the Labour government were going to do on day one, and do you remember that, you know, institutional failure was a day one issue as a starting point? And I think that kind of gave us this idea that there was a sense of an understanding about the state that the sector was in and the need it would have for immediate support. And none of that has materialised. And instead, we've got this really extraordinary, I thought, series of comments from the Skills Minister about it was just like a list of, you know, here are things that have been going wrong for the best part of a decade, but we're going to lay them all at the door of universities right now at a time when they've got least capacity to withstand yet another attack. And the list doesn't even make sense. I mean, we've just talked about international students. International students are not using public money. That is the most fundamental blooming point. They are bringing additional money into the system, so you can take them off the list. Executive pay is at most a symbolic issue. I do think the sector needs to get its head around that it's got to do something about that, because it just keeps coming back as a sort of battering ram for it. But it won't make a blind bit of difference to university finances if every vice chancellor took a pay cut or got paid a bit less. It's just not a relevant issue. Graduate outcomes is something something that the sector, you know, through its regulator is focusing on. Teaching quality, the sector is focusing on it. You can knock everything off that list and just sit there with your head in your hands thinking, what was the point of this? What has it actually achieved other than yet more red meat to the Telegraph readers for their ridiculous below the line comments? Apologies to anybody who is a Telegraph reader and contributes below the line.
Yes. Have you, James, have you actually looked below the line on this article? Because to the extent to which this op-ed and accompanying commentary from the Telegraph might have been aimed at calming its readers, it doesn't appear to have.
Jim, I hate being such a centrist dad about this and doing like a on the one hand, but on the other hand. But on the one hand, right, there is clearly issue here in that universities have become an easy sort of yardstick to say like, well, this is wrong, this isn't working, you should get paid less, why can't you do these useful things, etc., etc. I don't know if you've seen other public services. I don't think the idea that universities are unduly wasteful or profligate or not contributing to growth is true. Like, I just do not believe that's true compared to any other reasonable sort of measurement. I also think at the same time that there is a wider cultural challenge for universities, and this is always the case, of we are reliant on a broad base of tax base to say, yes, we are happy to pay tax by virtue of the bit of the fees that don't get written off, albeit that is getting lower, for you to go and do some socially useful things. And the minister is going to try and say, as they are bound to do and as is their right to do, we think these socially useful things are X, Y, and Z. Where I think the equation doesn't add up is if at the same time you take money out of the sector by doing things like a really harsh and sort of absurd set of immigration reforms, you will get less value for money, not more. It's what my family call it. You're being penny wise but pound foolish on this one, Jim, I think.
I guess the really confusing thing for me, Roscoe, when I was reading this was Jackie Smith appears to be saying that universities haven't cut hard and fast enough. But presumably, if they were cutting harder and faster, that would really impact the student experience. And you know, almost in the same paragraph, she's saying students' interests need to be protected. It doesn't add up, does it? Unless the government genuinely thinks there's still loads of fat in the system to be trimmed.
Speaking from somebody in a university, it definitely feels like we're cutting hard and fast. It just seems to be completely tone deaf, I think, on the hard work and effort that is going on in institutions across the country to control costs, reduce spending, and to ensure that institutions remain financially sustainable. Institutions every day will be making really difficult decisions to try and maintain the student experience while meeting those requirements. I thought it was fascinating that she talks about investment in teaching facilities when there has been no capital support from government for well over a decade. And again, the only way at the moment that institutions are able to kind of meet their capital requirements is precisely by bringing in international fee income.
Smita, do you remember that moment earlier on in the year when Peter Kyle said that the Tory government's war on higher education was over? That feels like a long time ago now, doesn't it?
Yes, I do remember it. And yes, it feels like a long, long time ago.
I still think the mood music is much better. And to give some credit, I don't think the last government would have increased tuition fees by inflation, which of course we know has been wiped out by the national insurance increase, but is nonetheless a good thing for the sector. And I think the way Jackie Smith was talking does hint that future increases are possible, if not a dead cert.
Oh, I think I entirely agree with that, James. I mean, so I found that the thing in the Telegraph frustrating. I didn't understand the point of it. I felt it didn't make good points. But I don't think we can compare the attitude of this government towards universities to what we had seen in the previous several iterations of Conservative government. So there's definitely been an improvement. I think what I slightly despair about is that there doesn't seem still to be a vision for higher education that goes beyond reacting to the latest, you know, whatever sort of small issue is thrown up. That becomes the lens through which the whole of higher education is viewed, you know. So the franchising, financing issues, the free speech issues, they still are driving all government's reaction to this, rather than stepping back and saying, fine, there may be problems in some areas, in some issues. But overall, we have a huge asset, one of the few remaining assets this country has. How do we nurture it? How do we get it to where we need it to be, given all the other constraints we're operating under? And that bit is missing. I mean, maybe it's happening in government. I fear it's not. But that should be the thing that they are also talking about alongside responding to, as I say, whatever the latest small problem that's been identified. I don't mean to diminish these things. I mean, the contained problems that have been identified.
But James, this is the big issue, isn't it? Because, you know, notwithstanding the fact that there's a line in the article that says we've moved OFS away from distracting campus culture wars issue in an article that appears to be mainly about, you know, putting universities in the middle of a culture war. Notwithstanding that, it's now mid-May. If we were going to get something that was kind of visionary, we'd have had it pitch rolled by now, wouldn't we?
Well, I don't know. I mean, a lot of the stuff in the immigration white paper was quite a large surprise at the last minute, so I wouldn't rule out something entirely. I think the bigger thing here, and I think it speaks to Smita's and Roscoe's point, is you assume Labour governments will do predictably Labour government type things, so they will always be judged to a different standard to which Conservative governments, you assume, will do Conservative government type things. And then when they, you know, do sort of being tough on migration, when they talk about these culture wars issues like VC pay, you end up thinking, well, what is some of the material difference here in your tone? Although the things you do materially are obviously different. I think the thing that makes me despair about this while we're sort of in the realms of despair is some of the issues in higher education are so structurally massive, whether you look at, you know, the number of students who are now in work to be able to afford to study, chronic shortage of housing, challenges with graduate jobs, you know, what on earth we could do about AI, a million and one things, Jim. And this thing we are bloody talking about yet again is vice chancellor's pay. Like, I think it is important. I think symbols are important. But on the list of things, if I was sat there saying, here's the to-do list, telling vice chancellors off for getting paid quite a lot of money would be somewhere quite, you know, in the bottom quartile, I would say.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we've discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcast. And if you want to get ahead of everything going on in UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Smita, Roscoe, James, Michael, Sam for making it all happen. We'll be back next week. Until then, stay wonky.